Today on the show, we continue our series, Logic Saves Lives. This installment focuses on two topics, the appeal to force and the appeal to fear. I'd like to begin the show today with a question that was asked on School Sucks Podcast on November 22nd, 2009, in our 17th show. To refresh your memory.
The state's facade of honor and benevolence. Critical thinking question, what's it hiding? In other words, what emerges from behind that facade to confront people who dared to stand up and call it a facade? What emerges to confront people who apparently have, I don't know, missed the most important messages of public education? That you're supposed to be obedient to authority, and that you are supposed to conform or fit yourself into predictable and easily manageable groups. But have also missed perhaps the most important lesson, that if those two types of training fail, you are still expected to remain indifferent and apathetic to what's going on. You're supposed to feel as if you are only one person, and what could you possibly do to affect any kind of meaningful change? What lurks behind that facade, ready to confront people who realize that all of these lessons are total nonsense? To confront people who have decided that they're supposed to be free, and they've also decided to start acting like it.
Three years later, in a world where that facade has worn even thinner than it was in 2009, we revisit this topic. Today we're going to be discussing a documentary called Derek J's Victimless Crime Spree.
People will criticize what I do with civil disobedience. They'll assume that I'm stupid and that I'm not aware that the government has this legitimacy over me and that I have to follow these rules, or that I don't know what the consequences will be. And they would only assume that I'm stupid if they assumed they were using some sort of logic to support their arguments.
Hi, I'm Derek J. I'm an activist originally from Philadelphia. To me, an activist's calling is to actively work to advance a cause. The cause for which I work is personal freedom. I believe my life is best when I engage in voluntary interactions and self-government. I reject the idea that anyone else has a higher claim to my life or my body than I do. I see people who call themselves the government as a threat to my personal freedom. I realize you may feel differently, but my relationship with the people who call themselves the government is completely involuntary. I don't want a politician to represent me. To me, government is the idea that one group of people can coerce everyone to comply with an edict or face increasing punishments up to and including death. Despite perhaps the most noble of intentions, the best government services are a far cry from what could be provided for by voluntary interactions. Besides, the people who call themselves the government wage wars and put peaceful people in jail for crimes involving no victims. If Starbucks used some of its money to drop bombs, I wouldn't shop there. So why would I support the American Empire? The Empire does not require my consent.
Hey everyone, just a couple of quick notes here before we get started. This is an edited version, a very edited version of the September 13th live show. We went off in a lot of different directions in our conversation, and in order to keep it focused on the topic that I wanted today's show to address, I did quite a bit of clipping and snipping, but as always, there is video of these live shows available, and I will put this one up on YouTube on the School Sucks Podcast channel. So if you want to see the whole unedited show, there will be a link to a playlist in the show notes. Our guests, Michelle Seven and Derek J. Freeman, both activists out in Keene. And today we will discuss the appeal to force, the argumentum ad baculum, and to a lesser extent, the appeal to fear through the lens of this documentary film, Derek J's Victimless Crime Spree, which chronicles an activist's first year in Keene, New Hampshire, and provides a very clear answer to that question that was raised at the very beginning of today's show. But it does so in a very empowering way. This is a very effective and enjoyable film. It is executive produced by Ian Freeman of Free Talk Live, and also produced and edited by another gentleman out in Keene named Bo Davis, formerly of Liberty on Tour. Our guests, Michelle and Derek, you might notice pretty good on the old radio. They are both hosts of Free Talk Live. Derek is actually in the process right now moving to Washington, D.C. to take a job with Adam Kokesh and his Adam versus the Man podcast. They're actually starting a new comedy show. It's going to be 5 days a week, similar, as Derek described it, to The Daily Show. Probably not slanted so far to the left, though. Anyway, can't say enough good things about this documentary. I was hooked into it right from the very beginning. It opens with a very interesting, might even say kind of haunting, interview with Aldous Huxley from 1958. Aldous Huxley is the author of the book Brave New World, which we've talked about on this show in the past and many of you are familiar with, strangely enough, from school. What a weird place to be introduced to such ideas. So I tracked the video down on YouTube and I just wanted to play a little bit more than what was included at the beginning of the film Derek J's Victimless Crime Spree. Let this run and then we'll get right into the show. Thanks for listening. Take care.
Mr. Huxley, in your new essays, you state that these various enemies of freedom are pushing us toward a real-life, brave new world, and you say that it's awaiting us just around the corner. First of all, can you detail for us what life in this brave new world, which you fear so much, or what life might be like?
Well, to start with, I think this kind of the dictatorship of the future, I think will be very unlike the dictatorships which we've been familiar with in the immediate past. I mean, take another book prophesying the future, which was a very remarkable book, George Orwell's 1984. Mm-hmm. Well, this book was written at the height of the Stalinist regime and just after the Hitler regime. And there he foresaw a dictatorship using entirely the methods of terror, the methods of physical violence. Now, I think what is going to happen in the future is the dictators will find, as the old saying goes, that you can do everything with bayonets except sit on them. That if you want to preserve your power indefinitely, you have to get the consent of the ruled. And this they will do partly by drugs, as I foresaw in Brave New World, partly by these new techniques of propaganda. They will do it by bypassing the sort of rational side of man and appealing to his subconscious and his deeper emotions and his physiology even, and so making him actually love his slavery. I mean, I think this is the danger, that actually people may be in some ways happy under the new regime, but they will be happy in a situation where they oughtn't to be happy.
But let me ask you this. You're talking about a world that could take place within the confines of a totalitarian state. Hmm. Let's become more immediate, more urgent about it. We believe, anyway, that we live in a democracy here in the United States. Do you believe that this brave new world that you talk about could, let's say, in the next quarter century, the next century, could come here to our shores?
I think it could. I mean, that's why I feel it's so extremely important here and now to start thinking about these problems, not to let ourselves be taken by surprise by the new advances in technology. I mean, for example, in regard to the use of the drugs, we know there's enough evidence now for us to be able, on the basis of this evidence and using a certain amount of creative imagination, to foresee the kind of uses which could be made by people of bad will with these things, and to attempt to forestall this. And in the same way, I think with these other methods of propaganda, we can foresee and we can do a good deal to forestall. I mean, after all, the price of freedom is eternal vigilance.
You write in Enemies of Freedom, you write specifically about the United States. You say this, writing about American political campaigns. You say, all that is needed is money and a candidate who can be coached to look sincere. Political principles and plans for specific action have come to lose most of their importance. The personality of the candidate, the way he is projected by the advertising experts, are the things that really matter.
Well, this is, during the last campaign, there was a great deal of this kind of statement by the advertising managers of the campaign parties, this idea that the candidates had to be merchandised as though they were soap or toothpaste, and that you had to depend entirely on the personality. I mean, the personality is important, but there are certainly people with an extremely amiable personality, particularly on TV, who might not necessarily be very good in positions of political trust.
Well, do you feel that men like Eisenhower, Stevenson, Nixon, with knowledge of forethought, were trying to pull the wool over the eyes of the American public?
Hey, everybody, welcome to School Sucks Live. Today is what? It's like September 13th?
It is.
And my co-host tonight, Jason Osborne. How you doing?
I am doing well, sir. Good to see you again.
Well, did you have a good 9/11?
I did.
This just became a socially acceptable thing to say because somebody new is listening to us and they're saying, did the one host of that show just wish the other host of that show a happy 9/11? That's, my goodness, that's unacceptable. 9/11 is now a holiday.
It is.
And we can wish people happy holidays. 9/11 is now called Patriots Day. Do you know this?
I only know that because you told me before the show.
It's on
I'm a little confused because I believe that there's a Patriots Day as well in like March or April. So I don't know how they can have two.
Why not 365?
Every day is Patriots Day.
Sure. Now, patriotism, we know what that's about, right? Nationalism. On this show, we kind of talk about the opposite, don't we? Critical thought. Yeah. Reasoning, and we are currently doing this big series on logical fallacies, logic and logical fallacies. And this is a very, very important thing for people to understand because it helps us get away from all of these fallacious arguments. Understanding the traps that people try to set for you with their rhetoric and in their conversations allows us to learn our way out of all that is force-fed to us for 15,000 hours of our lives through the government schooling process.
That's right.
So I'm actually very excited about the show tonight because we are going to start exploring our second fallacy. And last week we had Larkin Rose. You missed Larkin Rose, but I thought he was great. Are you familiar with Larkin's book, The Most Dangerous Superstition?
I have heard of it, not read it.
Okay. What do you think the most dangerous superstition is? Guess.
Man, the state.
Yes, yes. This myth of authority, that there is this thing called government that has legitimate authority over all of us. And Larkin goes through this whole book dispelling this myth, right? And
so the myth is that it is around the legitimacy of that.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. So we did a little cliffhanger at the end of the show. What happens when people outgrow this myth? What's waiting for them? Uh-huh. Right. And the second fallacy, because this was called the argumentum ad verecundium, the appeal to authority. And all government is defended and rationalized through some form of argument ad verecundium. Right. But when people say, no, that's dumb, that doesn't make any sense, I've outgrown that, you know, then the next thing that they're often introduced to is not even a real logical fallacy as much as it's a thinly veiled threat. But we have to talk about it here because of our relationship to the state or the people calling themselves the government and the state. It is probably the thing that if we ever intend to speak out about our rejection of the myth of government authority, it's probably what we're going to encounter next. And it is called the argumentum ad baculum, the appeal to force. So tonight, I'm very excited. We have two guests.
Two.
And they are
at the same time?
Yes. Oh. And they are both experts on this subject. The first one is Michelle Seven, and she has been an activist. She'll tell us more details, but for over 20 years, right? So she is a veteran in definitely an expert in understanding this appeal to force. If you don't do this, I will hurt you. Something bad will happen to you by my hand or by my command. The other gentleman is named Derek J. Freeman, not a veteran, but definitely put himself through an accelerated course in this subject over the course of the last year or so.
So before we go any further, and before we give this an actual definition, I want to bring them both on the show. Derek and Michelle, are you guys there?
Not a veteran.
Yes, good evening. Put
Hi, Brett Osborne. Derek J. here. Happy to be with you tonight, talking about logical fallacies and talking about Derek J.'s victimless crime spree.
Excellent. So even though you have both seen plenty of this fallacy in real life, were you familiar with such a thing?
Well, I studied philosophy in school, so I'm familiar with arguments as, you know, from the formal perspective.
I was not, but I know a threat when I hear one. So, you know, that's what this really seems to be to me.
Well, I thought that we would give it a definition. And there were a couple of examples that I thought were somewhat amusing, even though this is a very serious subject. But the actual description is the argument, and they put it in quotes here because it's not an argument, is actually an explicit or veiled threat. In effect, the argument says, accept my position or I'll punish you. The phrase ad baculum is a Latin phrase meaning appeal to the stick. Baculum was a walking stick, as I understand. Naturally, such sticks were sometimes used to give an opponent a good drubbing. The appeal to force is sometimes confused with the appeal to fear. The distinction is this. The appeal to force is a threat. The speaker will personally do something to punish the listener. And of course, we can swap out speaker and listener for whatever situation we're in where we encounter this. The appeal to fear is only a warning. The speaker is foretelling something bad will happen to the listener, but is not threatening to be the cause of that harm. So some examples of the appeal to force, the parental one, it's bedtime, don't give me any sass, or I'll give you a spanking. And also a historical one from the Spanish Inquisition, Osborne. How about this? I'm going to try to read this in my best Spanish Inquisition voice. The Grand Inquisitor. That was 40s radio guy. Sorry, that was 40s radio guy. I always confuse 40s radio guy with the... I'm going to read it in my regular voice. Ugh. The Grand Inquisitor might be very interested in your views denying the dual nature of Christ. So those are, like I said, both thinly veiled threats. Now, this is the part that I thought was interesting. Of all the fallacies, the ad baculum fallacy may be the most difficult to reconcile with some form of legitimate reasoning. The ad baculum fallacy does not so much imitate good reasoning as announce that every effort at reasoning has come to an end. Now violence will be used instead. Persuasion is not the point, only compliance. For this reason, I have doubts that the ad baculum should be considered a fallacy at all. But like I said, it needs to be covered right here. We wanted to try and anchor the show tonight around a documentary that Derek J. recently started called Derek J's Victimless Crime Spree, right, Derek?
That's it, right. Thank you, Brett. And I want to make the plug clear to the listeners who haven't yet stumbled upon the documentary, Derek J's Victimless Crime Spree. It's free online at victimlesscrimespree.com. It's also premiering here where I'm broadcasting from in Keene this Saturday, and we're having a poster giveaway contest for those who can't attend the live premiere. They can sponsor a seat. So those who would like to make a donation to sponsor a seat at the premiere can do so by donating via the chip-in at victimlesscrimespree.com. And those who do will be entered into a poster giveaway contest. And these are very exclusive posters, by the way. There are only 5 in existence. And thank you for plugging the film.
Derek, any other names I need to mention at the top of the top billing for that?
The Keene Police Department. They played a very big role.
They are kind of the stars, too, or certainly the antagonists in that film.
So police officers showing up to your premiere on Saturday?
You know, thanks for asking, Osborne. I spent a long time last night and this morning making some extra frilly, pink, glittery invitations to personally invite the Keene Police. I went down to the Keene Police Department this morning and shot some video of me personally inviting Fenton P. Moore Jr., the man who knocked me off of my bicycle and then punched me. I wanted to make sure that he could attend, and so no RSVP is required. He can just show up and bring the family. He is one of the stars of the film. So, yes, I hope that the Keene Police do show up, and I hope they do bring their families to showcase their heroism.
Yeah, that photo is so pregnant with meaning.
Oh, sure is.
You know, the one of the cop, you know, with his knee buried into you and his, and the way his arm is choking your neck and everything like that. And he's just so angry and aggressive. And you are obviously in discomfort, if not pain.
Yeah. But, and I'm clearly no threat.
But everybody, we're looking at the photo right now on our screen, and everybody looks like they're in pain in that picture. Now, Derek, to be fair, you look like you're in a lot more pain because you have a man's elbow in your ear. But if you look at his face, now the picture that I'm looking at, his head is cropped out of the top of it. But you can see his face and you can see enough of his expression. You can also see that his hand is reaching towards his shoulder where they keep their radios, right?
And that's right.
He is calling for help from somebody. And also, judging by the fact that there's a picture of this, he's also kind of in a maybe a little bit of a state of panic. It looks like that he is being surrounded by people who think that this behavior is unacceptable, if I'm painting the scene correctly.
You sure are. And it was a pretty odd scene. You've got it exactly. He was calling for backup. He did receive backup from not only the Keene Police Department, the Sheriff's Department, and the state police all showed up within seconds of his call. And what was really absurd is that there was no reason for the arrest. My charge was resisting arrest. There was no initial charge, which I was resisting. It was an unlawful arrest, in my opinion, of course. And so, yeah, it's strange. I think that his feelings were hurt. So the anguish that you see on his face is, I think, him coming to off of his adrenaline high, saying, oh, my gosh, what did I just do? I really didn't need to chase this boy. If I had just let him go, no one would have been any wiser. Nothing bad would have happened to me. Nothing would have happened to him. And, you know, we would have saved all this trouble and trauma. And when the people who are coming out of the activist center with video cameras are asking questions, why are you arresting this man? Why are you on top of him? Why are you hurting my friend? Silence. He has nothing to say. So I think, you know, there's a lot of introspection going on in that photo.
What is he trying to get met? What is he trying to get accomplished out of this whole interaction with you, in case anybody missed it or hasn't seen the documentary yet?
The purpose of his arresting me, which was unbeknownst to me and those present at the time, was to serve me with a no trespass order for all Keene schools, because I was handing out literature at the high schools and some of the middle schools in the area, which he also failed to do. So the whole purpose of him arresting me was to serve me with paperwork. And he did so violently he got me and forgot to serve me the paperwork.
Can you tell us about how this project came about? If somebody stumbles across this and says, where would such a thing come from? How would you introduce this?
Well, it was pretty organic. I would say documented my move here to the Shire up in New Hampshire from Philadelphia. And I am interested in videography. I was videotaping all the activism and things I was doing down in Philadelphia. And so I just continued that and maybe amped it up a little bit with the help of all the media here in Keene. So as I was just living my life, I was documenting what was going on, and some very interesting things happened. I happened to get arrested 5 times over the last year. And so that makes for really good video. And Ian and Bo and I had this discussion, just sort of saying, like, we should pool this all together and just make it one easily digestible film so that folks can get caught up. Because a lot of people who watch the freaking YouTube channel or watch my YouTube channel, they've seen bits and pieces of the things that have happened to me and the things that happen to activists here in Keene and the rest of New Hampshire. But they may not get the full picture of, like, why are the police aggressing against these people? Why are the activists acting in such a way towards the police when they say want to give the police a hug? That's a sort of a strange thing to do. But when you see the full picture of it all, it makes a lot more sense. So that's sort of where the film came about. It was an answer to those questions.
Now, here's a question, and it's about feedback on the documentary so far. When somebody sees you do something on YouTube and say like a 3 to 5 minute video and it's kind of out of context and nobody knows who you are, and sure, you're polite enough to make a good first impression, but I could see a lot of negative comments just for the reasons we've already discussed on the show coming your way about what somebody sees in that video. Have you found the comments to be more positive when people can get this whole contextual picture, your whole story? I mean, this film is almost 90 minutes long, right? And it tells pretty much from when you were in Philadelphia right up to you getting out of jail. So are you getting more positive feedback now, or is it still tough to gauge?
Yes, I am getting more positive feedback. That is for certain. From my YouTube channel, I tend to let the trolls lead the YouTube channel. There are more, it's seemingly more trolls than supporters of my personal YouTube channel. And that's where all the videos are seen individually. They're not spliced together in one digestible message. And so folks aren't getting the whole picture. And so they'll just think I'm stupid, or I invited the violence to come my way. But when people are able to see the whole movie, when I compare the comments on my personal YouTube page to the comments on the movie, the comments are night and day. There's so much support, overwhelming support for the actions when people get the whole context of what's going on. I mean, a lot of times in just my personal life, when I'm meeting with people on the street and sharing my experiences, they hear about my crime spree and they too will act as though I invited the violence to come my way, as if I somehow forced the police to chase me. And in some ways I recognize the reality where there will be violent consequences to my actions, but unlike statists, I just refuse to believe that the actions of the police are some kind of act of nature, that they arise out of some right. sort of natural state of the environment where a politician writes something on a piece of paper and it commands police like marionettes to just act in whatever way the law dictates. That's not what happens.
Sure. Well, and there are those who would compare this to, say, poking the bear, right? And then of course the bear is going to eat you when you poke at it. The difference being that, you know, these individuals are not animals driven by instinct, right?
Right, well, but they're not. I mean, the police are every bit as responsible for their actions as everyone else. And my peaceful actions should have no violent consequences in a society where personal responsibility is at the core. But, you know, for all my manners, I am a threat to the system because I shed light on their illegitimacy, the fact that they don't use reason and logic to support their actions, that what they are is a group of bullies who make demands of other individuals. And if those demands aren't met, then they use violence against them. And so just by holding a camera, that becomes evident. There's nothing special to what I've done except for, you know, where I've pointed my video camera on these bureaucrats who are acting so unruly.
I'd like to interject because I disagree. You said that they don't use reason and logic, and in keeping with the subject of tonight's podcast, I think that the government does use reason and logic. They just use it incorrectly. And because people, the public in general, is so poorly educated in rhetoric and discourse and logic and proper reasoning, then they swallow whole these incorrect belief patterns, such as the government is an authority, for one thing, and that because Derek lives in the town of Keene, that he is obligated to obey all of these laws, whether or not they are based on natural laws and they're proper and they're just and what have you. And Derek, I saw many people comment on forums, well, he just has to obey. He's supposed to obey based on what? So I would say that the government has successfully hoodwinked, and, you know, down through the education system and everything, hoodwinked people into to believing their lies, and have misused reason and logic to convince people of that.
You know, I have to say, I think you're right on that point, Michelle, because when a lot of people will criticize what I do, with civil disobedience, they'll assume that I'm stupid and that I'm not aware that the government has this legitimacy over me and that I have to follow these rules, or that I don't know what the consequences will be. And they would only assume that I'm stupid if they assumed they were using some sort of logic to support their arguments. So
I wonder, too, if there's like a more emotional piece to this, like people's anxiety and resentment about, you know, seeing somebody walking around outside of the cage, even though that cage is very much mental, can be very upsetting. So whenever people see that, wait a minute, the door to the cage is open, could we all just be walking around out there? Do you know what I mean?
Well, it's amazing how many people will, I mean, I know we're focusing on Derek's thing, but just to address that, it's amazing how many people, when they hear that I don't register my vehicles or I don't pay income tax or capital gains, how they all think I'm getting away with something.
I think people wanted to generally escape the personal responsibility of, you know, their unhappiness with their slavery. I think a lot of people are more aware of their slavery than they admit. And when they see people acting free, it may be upsetting to them because they're realizing that they have no one else to blame but themselves.
Well, this is a little bit different. This is kind of a different perspective on this, but sometimes I think it's easier for people to blame themselves. And you think there's a lot of language in government and politics that allows people to blame themselves. Because if you tell yourself a story, you know, in political participation that something is your fault, it's easier to escape this idea that we might just be subjected to the whims of sometimes dangerous, sometimes vicious people. And I think this is true in abusive relationships where if there's spousal abuse, one person might say about the other person, I shouldn't have provoked him, her when they were drunk. The kind of stories that people tell themselves to gain a greater sense of control. The we are the government, we get the government we deserved, to try and feel like they have more control over a situation.
Well, sure. If you're healthy at all, you don't want to be a victim.
Sure.
So so you want to, you know, think that you have some say-so in the matter. Sure.
So in politics, I think people often want to believe that the violence, the predation, the injustice is about something that we're all doing wrong, not being vigilant enough, or not voting for the right people. I think it's so much easier than facing the idea that we've been lied to our entire lives about what is essentially a fictional organization that really primarily attracts people who just want to impose their will on each other by force. Because if you acknowledge that, that conclusion demands actions, and those actions take courage, and that's not for everybody. Go ahead, Michelle.
But if things are, just because something is fictional, doesn't make it less impactful. For example, I remember being a kid walking home, you know, and it was dark out and everything. And my older brother had told me about, you know, a boogeyman and everything. And I can still feel the terror of walking by this one tree on, I mean, it was only 100, you know, yards from my house. And I was a really fast runner and I could book it, but I would be walking up to the tree thinking, because he told me that's where the boogeyman was. I'm like, okay, this time I'm going to cross. I'm not going to cross the street this time. Okay, this time I'm not going to run by. I can do this. The boogeyman's not real. There's no such thing. And I can still, to this day, 35 years later, feel the anxiety inside myself. So, despite the fact that there was no such thing as a boogeyman, and it's not legitimate, it still produced fear in me, the idea of it. So whether, you know, so many of us talk about how the government's not legitimate, da da da, it still can induce fear when the threat of it, you know, the other side of that threat is a gun or confiscating your children or your property or putting you in jail or what have you.
It's very, very real in people's minds, for sure. Derek and I were talking about this great turn of phrase in the documentary where it's not so much the chain of command that people should be focused on, but the chain of obedience.
That's right. And that was a phrase, to give credit where credit's due, that I borrowed from a wonderful YouTube video producer called Storm Clouds Gathering. And if folks want to see more of his excellent productions, I recommend they check him out. But yeah, that's the first time that I heard that phrase. Yes, I do see it as a problem. The whole freedom problem is one of obedience. you know, it's the magical belief in the chain of command that I object to. Those of us living today face the freedom problem caused instead by the person in the mirror and his unwillingness to face the consequences of living free today. And I truly believe that if everyone started following his own conscience today, I think you'd see billions of people suddenly refusing to pay for the endless wars of politicians, more money directed towards charity and mutual aid, and people spending more time serving friends and loved ones rather than some faceless corporate machine.
I think that that ties together with what you were saying, Michelle, about this very real fear about something that was entirely imaginary. And that yes. is that it doesn't matter. I think the whole way that we interface with that world, that political world, that government world, is it's so important what's going on in the heads of these people and through the mainstream media, more importantly, what's coming out of their mouth holes. But there's never any room for what's going on in the minds of people. It might be paid lip service, but that's really where the focus should be. The people who are attracted to power are generally always the same kinds of people. But I think people, when they first understand these ideas, they often want to say, let's end the Fed, or let's elect Ron Paul president. They go to the furthest thing away from themselves that they can possibly find, and they start there, which I think is why a lot of times people get burned out, they get frustrated, they give up.
Yeah, that's no plan at all. I mean, if people are interested in having security over their money, it starts with you. I know that's a really simple thing to say, and it may be easier said than done, but if people want to take control of their own money, then, you know, there are simple steps that an individual can take, like dealing in silver or Bitcoin rather than using Federal Reserve notes if one really hates the Fed.
You know, I was telling a friend today who I trade with that I received a 1 ounce silver round from Ian Freeman about 2 years ago, actually. And it was my first payment in for an agorist, you know, job in silver. And I cleaned his bathroom and tidied up his kitchen. And I am more proud of that 1 ounce of silver than I am in the $100,000 I made in trading the year before. The pride I have in that actual trade or whatever is much more significant. But I think that comes from having answered a question from a young age that really altered my course in life. And that is, you know, who owns me? And who do I belong to? And who's my master? And I don't think that people, you know, really ask that question so much. And, you know, one of my favorite Free Talk Live episodes I ever did was the one I did with you, Brett, and Stephanie. And the whole show was pretty much about first cause principles. And I really think that that is, there's a gross neglect within the schools, whether private or public. Essentially all private schools are public anyway these days because sure. they're overseen by the Department of Education. But I don't think people are taught to think critically, but they're also not taught to question. And they're also not taught to think from a first cause structure. So they're busy thinking about what the government has to do for them or what they have to do for the government without even considering the fact that they have indentured themselves and made themselves slaves by that mindset.
And this also ties in with our talk about obedience. Some of the people who've indentured themselves the most are the politicians, the police, and the bureaucrats. From your dealings, both of you, Derek, we can start with you. How obedient are these people? What are they obedient to? And how much fear have you observed in them through your dealings with them? Because I think that most people who've dealt with the police on a regular basis, or they've had many, many encounters over time, they realize that there is, I think it's fair to say, a narrow range of programmed responses to what you're doing.
Bo Davis was arrested on Monday, June 27th, 2011. I met Bo while being interviewed for a French TV news channel about public 420s in the square. He settled in Keene after a stint with Liberty on Tour. Bo was sentenced to 5 days in the Cheshire County House of Corrections for contempt of court. The next day, I was there at District Court doing Don't Take the Plea Deal outreach with Rapture. When Rapture returned from handing out flyers to people in the court lobby, he told me that a demo of copblock.org was being arrested upstairs.
Just as I'm about to walk out, Ademo's like, hey, Jason. Man, I'm like, huh? I look, Ademo's on the floor, handcuffed. You know, and at that point, Ademo filled me in on what had happened. He's like, dude, he's like, you aren't going to believe this. I got arrested for nothing.
I handed off my camera to Rapture, and he filmed the arresting bailiffs in the lobby.
Can anybody tell me what's happening with my friend?
Recorded.
Is that a policy that I can't record you?
I am saying under federal law, you have the right not to be recorded.
Okay, if you show me that policy, I'll be more than happy to shut this off.
I just told you what the federal law is. Now you got 2 minutes to shut it off, or I'm going to arrest you. Violation of my privacy.
Okay.
What you want to do?
Ademo was arrested for asking Judge Burke questions about wearing a hat in court and how that constitutes contempt.
Judge Burke, can I ask you a few questions about a hat and how that constitutes contempt? You think people want to pay for someone to be in jail for 5 days for wearing a hat? It's kind of ridiculous to waste taxpayer money on something like that, isn't it? Sir, I just want to have a conversation.
Bailiff, this person is threatening me about a decision that I just made.
I'm not threatening you. I'm asking him questions. Did I threaten you?
Threatening as a criminal offense.
What was my threat?
Come on, sir, you're in custody.
What was my threat?
You come in custody. Yes, sir.
I went to investigate myself and was arrested for video recording.
What? So, apparently Jason was just threatened if he didn't turn off his camera. I want to go see what this is about up here.
There is no video or audio allowed in this lobby.
There isn't?
Now shut it off. You go and get arrested.
Where's the statute?
It's right on the wall.
Oh. Can you show me?
I said...
Can you show me where it is on the wall?
You're under arrest.
No, sir. Okay. I just want to see where the law is.
You're under arrest.
No. I have work today.
Well,
this is...
You ain't going to make it. You got your...
What? Car. No. Wait.
Put it on the counter. Now.
Wait a minute. Hey, wait a minute. Let's just be friends here.
Yeah, three quick examples of three different arrests where the arresting officers appeared to me to feel threatened, and I wasn't doing anything violent insane. So they shouldn't. There's no need in my mind for them to have felt threatened. The first is that I was filming in City Hall, and the upstairs of City Hall is the district court here in Keene. I was within eyeshot of one bailiff for only a few seconds when he points his finger at me and tells me there's no audio and video recording in this lobby. And I asked a question, there isn't? And he said, no, now turn it off or you're going to be arrested. And there was only a 6-second break between the warning and the arrest. And this is just my perception, but I believe that he saw his legitimacy disappearing. He is a man of authority and expects, because this is what happens on a daily basis, that people will bend over for him and do whatever he commands them to do. Lift your arms up. Let me wave you down. Let me touch you here. And when people don't follow those orders, right after the command is given, he starts to see that he's not so big and tough, that people don't just follow him because he actually deserves that authority, that they're actually just afraid of him. So he struck fear in, or attempted to strike fear into me by, taking me away. And I even asked him, can't we just be friends here? And he was not interested in that sort of outcome. The second...
Before we go on with the second one, can I just come to that man's defense first?
If you must.
Because there's a part of the story that is left out where right before that in the documentary, he is asked very similar questions by a friend of yours named Jason, right?
This happened.
Is Jason Rupture?
This is Jason Rupture, now, who was filming upstairs asking questions that, of course, while I was not present, I could have no knowledge of.
Exactly. But this gentleman, it might be that his patience was tried because in the encounter with Jason Rupture prior to that, before the threat of violence was made, he lasted 26 seconds I timed that earlier today. So yes, maybe the second person only gets six, but the first person got a whole 26 seconds. And the way it went down was he makes an appeal to authority, right? Just like he did with you. He says,
well, yeah, he says, I quoted you the federal law, even though he really didn't. He was making things up. And I have to let you know, Brett, that even the movie is condensed for time. And so what you counted as 26 seconds is actually well over 2 minutes. It may have even been closer to 5 minutes.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. So Jason Rapture was upstairs. And because of that huge difference in time lapse, I mean, 5 minutes compared to 6 seconds, my only speculation as to why Jason wasn't arrested and I was, is that Jason is about twice my size. He's way bigger than the bailiff. I'm not. And so I'm someone that the bailiff could easily pick on. And I think it's more an impulsive thing, Brett and Osborne, because the officer, when questioned at the dance party, Cecilia, one of the hosts of Ladies in Keene here, she was present at the dance party and asked while filming, you know, you don't even know to whom this equipment belongs. Just to frame this for the listeners, a police officer had just taken what equipment I was responsible for. And Cecilia was intercepting and saying, well, you don't know who this belongs to. Why would you just take it? And the police officer said, I don't know. You know, he was totally honest that he said, I don't know who this belongs to. And she says, well, you're just going to throw a man to the ground? You don't even know who it belongs to? He says, yes. Oh. So I really think that they just do what they want. They ask questions later.
So on the poster, here's a couple of things that I like, or maybe I'm speaking more to the DVD cover. The Old Westie style font for Derek J's Victimless Crime Free. Good choice. But here's the thing that I like about this picture, okay? You have Derek, right? Now, you can look at Derek. You can tell that this man owns an iron. You can tell that he has a comb. You can tell that he has a collection of sharp razors. Right. And here he is, a very upstanding looking young man being dragged away by these two cops. And I think it creates this question in people's minds. What could that guy possibly have done? You don't have a balaclava on. You don't have a neck beard. you know,
those cops, I asked them straight up at Give Peace a Chance. For those who don't know, people in Keene occasionally will smoke openly in the central square in the park in the center of town. And I was attending that event that day. There was a heavy police presence, but they weren't doing anything. I even asked some of the officers, do you mind if I smoke? What would happen if I smoked this bowl? And they all responded with a do what you want sort of attitude. The cops are known to look the other way for people having open containers and smoking pot openly in the park. And so it really seems to be that they didn't have to make this arrest. But to give you the example of why I think they went through with following the order, the arresting officer for the Give Peace a Chance event was actually Jason Short, a man. But who you see in that poster are two women. And that may be confusing for some people that the arresting officer never even laid a hand on me. But the woman who was told, take him, I was serenading her with the song Give Peace a Chance, the John Lennon tune.
Yes.
And it took her well over a minute before she felt comfortable enough to put her hands on me. And even then, it took another officer to run from across the square, across the street, to initiate the arrest. The officer who was told to do it wasn't able to. I could see the anguish in her eyes. She really didn't want to put her hands on me. We had even made a verbal agreement earlier in the day that I wouldn't put my hands on her and she wouldn't put her hands on me. It's only appropriate. We're strangers. And she agreed. And I really believe that she intended to keep and honor her agreement. And so you can see it's difficult for her to make that arrest. You can see it in her eyes, even in the poster. It's not pleasant for these people sometimes. I mean, they want to be heroes. Ideally, they would like to rescue and save people and you know, win the day, right? But it must feel awful to take away a well-groomed contributing member of society and put him in a cage because that's what your boss tells you you have to do because that's how you earn your paycheck.
Well, you know, I'm not sure which of these two women is the sister-in-law of a friend of mine who I went to college with.
Oh my.
Yeah, but she is. And so I know kind of secondhand, you know, you weren't doing anything that they don't do.
Oh no, of course not.
You know, so how do you arrest someone for something that your boyfriend, lover, sister, brother does every day in the privacy of your own home?
Well, that's a great segue to the civil disobedience aspect of it, because what a lot of these officers say is, well, just do that at home. You know, we won't arrest you if you're doing it in your home. Don't do it openly.
We talked at the very beginning of the show about the public reaction to this, when the anxiety and maybe even the resentment that people have when they see people acting like they're free and acting on the realization that the most dangerous superstition, as Larkin Rose called it, is just that, a superstition. Now, I think I talked about it in kind of a callous and dismissive way, but I think it's important for us to recognize that these feelings exist and should be addressed in people. So what I want to know is, for you personally, what is the point of doing civil disobedience? And in the broader picture of what it's trying to communicate to other people's, what's the point there as well? Because at the very beginning of the documentary, you say that it's about achieving personal freedom. But I would think, just playing devil's advocate here, I would think that you would probably want to stay as far away from those types of people as possible if personal freedom was your goal.
To be frank, it's about following rational self-interest. I can't live with myself if I make certain decisions. And
okay.
So, you know, I need to follow what I believe to be right and good. And if people want to criticize me for saying that that's a, you know, it could be a suicidal tendency, then fair. That's fine. That's a fine criticism. That may be true. Like, I would prefer to be dead than unfree. And so I have to live free. And I don't want to wait for some fantasy future where perhaps politicians have laid it out for me or others have done the civil disobedience to make the world a freer place. I can't wait for that day of freedom. And so I won't wait. And that's why I do civil disobedience.
Now, Michelle, how about you? Not just what you've been involved with in Keene, but you've been at it a lot longer than that.
Well, I kind of started when I was like 12, I guess.
Okay.
I closed down my school. I went to a public school. An issue had come up between the school union and the labor union for Weyerhaeuser. I grew up in Oregon. And despite the laborers of Weyerhaeuser, the lumber industry, and the teachers, so the actual people that the unions were supposedly representing, despite them not being in agreement with the unions were pressing forward and insisting that students couldn't do a field trip that students would take every year from the entire county. But we would go and we'd plant these 25 seedlings and learn all about the lumber industry. And that's it was the foundation to the economy in Coos Bay, Oregon, and all of Oregon, actually. And it gave the lumber guys a chance to, you know, teach us about their craft. And considering, you know, like 30% or something like that of guys graduating from high school got involved in some fashion in the lumber industry. It was a really big deal. So I went at it from a principal perspective and discussed that with my teachers after being told that the unions had said no, that it was dangerous, that, you know, it was cutting in on the workers' time and, you know, they were having to volunteer some of their hours and blah, 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 and, which they were all willing to do. But I knew that my fellow students didn't care about it from that perspective. And so I was much smarter when I was 12 than I am at 44, I must say. Because I went and called up all my fellow students in the two different classes and told them, hey, you're not going to get an ice cream sandwich if we don't get to go. And they're like, what? they wanted their ice cream sandwich. And, you know, out of the 60 kids, there were only, you know, a couple that cared about the principals involved. I didn't even discuss the principals with those other people. And I called the radio station and I called the newspaper. And of course, there were lots of kids that wanted to be in the front of the newspaper. So they were willing to stand in front of the buses. And, you know, I shut the school down for the day and we ended up getting our field trip and stuff. But I've actually become more stupid as I've gotten older. And part of that has to do with pain. Because 2 years later, I was locked up for 4.5 months in a mental institution for being a manipulative subversive after going to a month and a half of school or being enrolled for a month and a half, but only attending about 6 days because I didn't want to get my head shaved by the girls that were threatening to shave my head, for one thing. And also, I didn't want to be surrounded by stupid people all day long. Yeah. And I really wanted to just watch MTV and smoke pot, but and, you know, read whatever it is I wanted to read and not be bothered with, you know, whatever time, my time that was being wasted in high school. So I got called in and they, teachers and there were two police officers there and dean and actually a political figure and my mom and all my teachers. And so they didn't like that. They weren't being paid since my butt wasn't in my seat. And so I was called a manipulative subversive and I was locked up in a mental institution for 4.5 months. And
at how old?
I was 14.
Okay.
Yeah. And most of that time I was in solitary confinement, a level zero, meaning I had to eat all my meals alone and what have you. So, which meant I had to educate myself. So I got locked up and was able to do the very thing that I wanted to do anyway, which was be left alone. Because all I wanted to do was be left alone at that time in my life. So from a very young age, you know, younger than most people are ever even thinking about these sorts of things, I had already felt the heavy hand of the state.
Yeah.
My boyfriends had been locked up. By that time, I already had a few friends that were institutionalized, meaning that they were going to, you know, they've now over the course of 30 years gone from a boys' ranch to, you know, foster care to detention homes to jail to prison and what have you. And these were all kids. We were all in gifted programs together. We were all really smart, really healthy, physical athletes, what have you. And, you know, the state intervened and tried to ruin our lives. So my civil disobedience comes from the fundamental idea that I've known all my life, that I'm free. And, you know, I tell people that because I happen to be a Christian, so I tend to, a lot of my activism is kind of geared or has been geared before I moved to Keene toward Christians and sharing liberty with them, because I feel like they're so entrenched in the opposite of liberty.
So Michelle, you had a lot of these awful experiences while in school, and you yourself are an educator, you homeschool your kids, and you're a student of philosophy also. So I wonder if your civil disobedience is somewhat about educating others about the philosophy of self-ownership and the non-aggression principle. Because I don't
absolutely
know about, okay, good. Because I wasn't sure, but for me, when I discovered these philosophies, I became obsessed with how relevant they are. And I wanted to share the gospel, so to speak, right, with others. And in my opinion, the best way to educate others is to live your principles. And that's the reason I got involved with CivDis. It's because so many of my friends and loved ones, tell me if this has been your experience as well, but they believe that the government is voluntary and has the consent of the governed. And I had to show them that that's not true.
I don't think people are thinking that anymore, though, is a thing. And so what happens when you have a void that opens up because you've like cleared something out of your mind because you've realized that it's wrong? Well, that void, you know, something needs to fill it. And so I want to be right there with what I consider to be the correct answers, which are universal moral principles. And there are really only a handful of them.
People could live even freer than a civil disobedient if they did so in a closed environment, if they weren't open about it. They could, yeah, you know, they could trade with others and do agorism, for example. But I don't know if, like, what makes the difference for you, Michelle? Why would you do things openly rather than secretively?
Good question.
Because I don't hurt anybody. And I've never really call myself a civil disobedience activist until moving here, simply because people like to put labels. So I never called myself an anarchist. I never called myself a voluntarist. Those are all pretty recent labels to kind of put me in a group, I guess. But I believe whether it's because you have a neocortex as opposed to just a limbic system, and are therefore not just an animal, that the only way that you can exercise your humanity is by being able to opt out and say no. And if you can't say no, and if you can't agree to things or disagree from things, then you're not free, and so you're not human.
Guys, thank you so much for participating in this conversation tonight. The documentary, Derek J's Victimless Crime Spree, on YouTube. The website is victimlesscrimespree.com. These two are going to stick with us just a little bit longer at schoolsucksproject.com/live. So join us there. Let's say in 7 to 10 minutes, we will be back and we will continue this discussion. Guys, thank you so much.
Awesome. Thank you.
Peace. I move that the court dismiss each of the charges several times, and each time they were denied. Even the most basic of my motions were denied. I move the court to consider the text of the law to be relevant. Denied. I move the court to consider the U.S. Constitution relevant. Denied. Since I was in court anyway, I move the court to consider modifying my bail conditions so that I can carry a gun to defend myself, which was also denied.
I'm here today under duress to answer to charges by the state that I disturbed the peace and dignity of the state, as I believe I proved today by calling witnesses, making motions, and sound argumentation. I am a person dedicated to peace and dignity. The alleged charges took place at one such celebration of peace, dignity, and freedom. Not only am I innocent of the alleged charges, but as evidence will show, I was the victim of aggression by agents of the state who acted outside the law and put into effect the tremendous waste of time and energy and resources of this court and the taxpayers of this town. I posit that it is impossible to interfere with government administration when law enforcement is acting outside the law. No victim can be identified in these cases except myself.
Judge Burke found me guilty on all three charges and sentenced me to 90 days in the Cheshire County House of Corrections for obstructing government, another 90 days to be served after that for verbally resisting arrest, and imposed a $1,240 fine for refusing to answer questions. All but the fine were suspended upon the condition of obedient behavior.
Hey, everybody. Just wanted to do a quick follow-up discussion about today's show. One of the things that we spent a lot of time discussing, civil disobedience, is actually a topic that has generated quite a bit of controversy within the School Sucks community in the past. And specifically, I think most of it actually came from the episode that I referenced at the very beginning of the show, which was the 17th installment of the podcast, The State's Facade of Honor and Benevolence, where my guest was Kat Canning. Now, I never really endorsed civil disobedience. I've never said anything like this is something that everybody should be doing, because you can't really say that about almost anything, can you? It's certainly not something that I'm able to participate in myself with, my goals, because I can't spend time in jail. And when it comes to personal freedom for me, I try to put each year 365 days in a row where I'm not behind bars, where I have access to my own property and I'm in charge of making my own schedule. And I've thought about this a lot, and I've seen a lot of smart, courageous, and people that I really respect out in Keene doing some things that I've said I could never do that. That would make so little sense for me to do that. But I guess if I've passed judgment on them in the past based on what is good or not good for me, that's something I probably should have thought about a little bit more. And after having this conversation with Derek and Michelle and watching this movie, I'm thinking a lot more about this issue. And I think that we've talked about it in the past in ways that were maybe somewhat prescriptive. Like, people should do this, people shouldn't do this. And, this is just it's a personal choice. And if some people are set up to do this, and this is what gives them the same kind of satisfaction that I get from day in and day out being on the outside of a jail cell, I understand that. I understand what Derek said, that I am not going to sit around and wait to act free. That resonated with me. And the interesting thing about that is like, as long as the state exists in people's imagination and people walk around calling themselves government, there's going to be all kinds of dilemmas. So it becomes a question of, where do you want to make the sacrifice, right? Do I want to sacrifice certain things? Do I want to back down from potential altercations with bureaucrats and law enforcement people so I can make it to work, so I can work with a young person, so I can maybe share not so much my political philosophy, but some, you know, methodology to think clearly and rationally with them, even if we're just talking about some stupid standardized test, because that's what I try to do. So maybe there have been times where I've said, I don't have time for this shit. I will back down to be able to do the rest of the things that I need to do, that I think are, you know, the most valuable things for me to be doing to advance these ideas. But if somebody takes that stand, their sacrifice is just deferred, right? Because they're going to lose time, they're going to lose money, they're going to lose their freedom as a result of those actions. But am I still only able to see this from my point of view? Because we know the choice that I've made. I'll sacrifice at the point where somebody is going to threaten me with force if I don't comply, so I can do the things that I think I'm best at doing. I can't do anything good in a jail cell. But am I even using the right language? Because I don't understand that other side, just because it's something that seems so foreign to me. Is sacrifice even the right word? Because I call it a sacrifice. You know, I sacrifice taking the opportunity to take that principled stand, but I don't stand up to organized crime. I don't stand up to street gangs. I don't stand up to thugs. I mean, I worked with some pretty thuggish kids back in the day, kids who had committed murder, kids who tried to stab me with pens that they sharpened like shivs. That was a word that I learned at that job. My goal was to diffuse crisis and conflict. So, you know, I could move forward to, you know, do the things that I thought at the time that I was pretty good at, which was teaching, communicating with kids who could be reached. I wasn't going to waste, you know, that time fighting some battle with a thug whose emotional state was impermeable to any, you know, moral or rational argument that I could make. And this was, you know, different kids through the years, but these were usually people who wanted to engage me, to bring me into the activity where they felt the most comfortable and they were the most competent. And that activity was violence. So in my life today, and fortunately these kinds of crisis win-lose situations happen, you know, a lot less often now than then, I choose de-escalation over engagement, just like I did back in my days at that school. But what that meant was that those battles were always going to continue, because not taking action means that nothing's really going to change, is it? So this is a tough one, because civil disobedience is what changed things in the past. At some point, some people had to stand up and say no. It makes it a tough issue for me, I'll tell you. And I understand why this has been such a, you know, a contentious topic in the past. I was lucky enough to have Derek and Michelle stick with us after midnight, and we did an after show, the After School Sucks special, for about an hour and a half. Now, I don't think both of them were with me and Jason that entire time, but I did express some of my concerns. I did express some of the issues that I had had with civil disobedience in the past. Ian Freeman from Free Talk Live joined our conversation for a little while. I definitely appreciated all of their extra participation in the live show, and I will definitely say that I walked away from that conversation feeling like I had learned a few things. And we had a follow-up show back in, it was either the end of 2009, the beginning of 2010. I'm going to find it and unarchive it if you want to hear it. It has been taken out of the feed and will appear in the bonus content section, but I'm just going to put it back in the feed if you're interested in learning a little bit more about this topic. I think it's episode 19, I want to say, and its name is something like The Civil Disobedience Onion Peeling Layer 1. I wasn't always so good at titles. But that shows up for free, and sometime this weekend, I'm going to send out that after show to everyone who is a subscriber. So if you want to hear that, go to schoolsucksproject.com/support. You can get directions from there, or you can go directly to schoolsucks.podomatic.com, and you can see up in the upper right-hand column, there's the PayPal button and the instructions. We ask for $6 a month. It really helps the show. And I just want to wait until this weekend to make sure I have my list updated so I don't leave anybody out. I hope this show was thought-provoking and useful, and we will be back very soon. Tonight is actually Wednesday night. So tomorrow, if you're hearing this on Thursday, which is going to be September 20th, think about tuning in to the live show. Think about calling in. It's at 10 p.m. Eastern, schoolsucksproject.com/live. We're going to be talking about psychopaths. Well, all right. See you later.